Thank you. Thanks to Allison. This program is in its 10th year, so I think that's kind of a landmark. And the program has involved 40 different writers in 16 different states throughout the U.S., creating what I think Allison is right, a community of writers that is spread throughout this country. And hopefully will continue as the years go by. I would like to just say a couple of thank yous and then sort of get right to the work, which is why you're here. First of all, thanks to Allison Deming and to Karen Falkenstrom, who put this program together and has made our visit here so far quite wonderful. I'd also like to thank all the writers that we have met and will meet tomorrow as well, who have given generously of their time and have shared their experiences in writing and just in living, which is also a part of writing. And last but not least, the judges for this program, the poet Mark Doty, who I believe read here last year, who selected Laura's work, and Melissa Pritchard, who is here this evening and who I had the good fortune to meet in New Mexico, I guess about 4 years ago, and who selected David Reynolds' work. I'd like now to introduce Melissa Pritchard. Melissa Pritchard received the Flannery O'Connor Award for her first book, Spirit Seizures. Her stories have been anthologized and cited in prize stories, including the O. Henry Awards, Best of the West, the Literary Ghost Great Contemporary Ghost Stories, the Pushcart Prize, and Best American Short Stories. She's received grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Illinois Arts Council. Her novel, Phoenix, was published by Cane Hill Press, and stories from her second collection, The Instinct for Bliss, have appeared in the Paris Review, the Southern Review, and other magazines. She teaches in the creative writing program at Arizona State University. And I think probably the best thing, the most important thing about Melissa Pritchard is that when you read her stories, they are extraordinarily powerful, mystic, and they stay with you. And so it's my pleasure to welcome Melissa Pritchard.
Thank you. Before I introduce the two winners of this year's Poets and Writers Exchange Program, I'd like to say how much I wish Mark Doty, who served as this year's poetry judge, was with us this evening. He is a valiant and compassionate artist, surely one of the best poets writing today. And how quickly he must have recognized a similar courage and compassion shaping the poems of this year's winner in poetry, Laura Kaziski. Reading her manuscript, Housekeeping in a Dream, I was struck by her rigorous commitment to the expression of truths, whether home truths or foreign ones. Always in her work, I found the unmistakable urgency of the human heart speaking with clarity of what it knows and feels in imagery nothing short of wondrous. Laura Kaziski received her Bachelor of Arts and Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. Her poetry has appeared in numerous magazines, including the Antioch Review, the Kenyon Review, the Missouri Review, Plowshares Poetry, and the most current edition of the Pushcart Prize. In 1993, she received the Alice Faye de Castagnola Award for a work in progress from the Poetry Society of America. This year, she was awarded a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Her first volume of poetry, Wild Brides, selected by Sharon Olds, received the Elmer Bobst Award for Emerging Writers and was published by New York University Press. Poetry, said W.H. Auden, can do 101 things, delight, sadden, disturb, amuse, instruct. It may express every possible shade of emotion and describe every conceivable kind of event. But there is only one thing that all poetry must do. It must praise all it can for being and happening. Laura Kaziski's poetry, beyond its excellent measure of craft and beyond its clear impression upon the heart, indeed praises all it can. I'd like to introduce this year's winner, the Poets and Writers Exchange Program in Poetry, Laura Kaziski. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'd also very much like to thank all the poets and writers, people who've been so good to us, and Fraser Russell in particular, for just really babysitting us really well for what's probably been a long week for him. So this first poem is called Lady Luck, and it's a new poem, and I wrote it after thinking about some various, you know, tabloid-type tragedies that have been in the news lately, and the kind of combination of bad luck or predetermination that seems to rule our lives. And so this is about Lady Luck and God falling in love. Somewhere there's a sad blue dress, and a woman's wearing it to work. God gawks down at her on earth, but all he sees is just a smeared blue something, something watery or melted, something spread like blue milk spilled all over a wax white tray. The corn is female too, and grows magenta hair by August, and it smells like teenage girls on horses sweating in the fields. Flesh and leather, and that hair, magenta, wet. The wind creaks with corn, and the planet's a foggy oyster from up there, a sad blue dress, and overrun with rabbits. Phantom ovaries shine behind a glistening wish of rabbit bone, like microscopic pearls let loose all over the world. When God falls in love with Lady Luck, something's torn from a parchment sack and born and scampers off on soft white paws that stir up and scratch off the church's dress of dust. And the woman on her way to work who wears the sad blue dress she'll never know is the whole cloth of earth. She never sees the sky, the cloud, the girl's damp blood hair of corn. Detergents churn the streams. A crucifixion in the fields wears a farmer's shirt and scares the bony birds with its empty, open flannel arms, and white powder falls from their wire feet as if their startled, hungry fear could dance to talc the moon's gym floor. When God asks Lady Luck to dance, nothing's sacred anymore. The serial killer orders a piece of apple pie at a diner in Arizona. The jury is moved by the TV movie and decides to set him free. The hunters shoot each other, thinking that they've seen neon orange deer fleeing between the trees. And the lottery is never won by a man who loves his wife. Bullet wind is silver, and the air around the bullet is a razor. And the singe above it's like a silver fingernail file that's dusted with fingernail, filed down to human flour. And August's ground to chalky powder, and the horses do not know the teenage girls will soon fall out of love with them and into love with men, while the woman's dress rips open like a gift of sadness, appetite, or chance, equestrian and blinding as a white car's headlights on a whitewashed day. This was not an accident, the detectives say. The boys had not been drinking, and the witnesses saw nothing but a bird's pure scream. I read somewhere that Malaysian superstition is that if a person's face is painted while they're sleeping, when they fall asleep, their soul, you know, will leave their body and it can't find its way back because their face is painted. And this made me think of my mother, how she would demand always that I not wear makeup, you know, when I was a teenager, to bed. Something, you know, like your face would rot off or something if you can wear it on your face all day, but you can't wear it overnight. So I thought maybe this was somehow these things seem connected to me. And this is called self-fulfilling prophecies. And I begin it with the quote about the Malaysian's fancy that if a person's face is painted while he sleeps, the soul which has gone out of him will not recognize the body. And the sleeper will die or awake, a kind of female zombie in a cold, dark space. On Sunday, I'm in a department store choosing a crayon for my eyes. The cosmetic counter floats toward me like a ship of fluorescent light, and the girl behind it is perfect, half goddess in a tight white dress, though I see she has eaten her fingernails off by the bloody stumps of her fingers and the flesh between her teeth. Still, it's true what they say that each beautiful woman must bear a flaw of some kind. Some must draw on the mark themselves with an eyebrow pencil, and some must chew up their hands to get at it. She looks at my face and suggests a dark coal color to match my soul. Where is it? I ask her, and she happens to know. She takes me into a storage room where shelves sag with the weight of lipstick crates and a white mouse struggles in a trap of glue. It rips off its tail to try to get loose, just to get stuck on its face. It's clear there is no escape. Here, she says, we kept it just in case you came. She is so lovely, I end up buying twice as much as I need. And when I get home, I decorate my face like a birthday cake until my lips can be seen, red and pleading, miles and miles away. I wear it all night in the empty bed while my soul is freeze-dried in the sky and the janitor buries his bag of mice in a hole in the yard. Their little human hands are stiff and their pink eyes blink open and shut, shut and open like baby dolls in the grave. This poem is called Local Legend, and I had a terrible experience of finding a dead dog a year ago in the spring. In the backyard, it had obviously been there all winter, and it was full of bees, actually. And I, as soon as I saw it, I immediately thought of the town that I grew up in. It just somehow, there was just an absolute connection right there. And so I wrote this poem sort of combining the description of the dog and the description of the town, Local Legend. This morning, the awful surprise of a dead greyhound in lilies, silver on silver and hollow. The sky goes wild with laughter, and the seeds of doubt sprout small bald shoots in ground and glimmer like rosary beads in the hands of our local legend, Sister Lucy Ann, who claimed they turned from glass to gold one day at Mass. But we knew they never did. Sister Lucy Ann was lonely and getting old, and she wanted her name in the paper the way some of us want to be held and are perfectly willing to spin straw into fool's gold for it. And anyway, we knew the last real miracle here was when Catholic Central slaughtered Rockford 42-10. There was blood in the parking lot then. Glass shattered and sparkled like white eels on the church lawn. Toilet paper strung umbilical cords through trees, streaming wet by morning and white as ghouls against a purple October sky. They say two pom-pom girls in the Catholic cemetery took on the whole team themselves that night. There was the cold sweat of marble in the air. Stale green carnations, the earth kiss of mulch and wild hair. I know, I was there. Heed a warning the horoscope in the local paper almost never says, and that may be because Linda Lovelace is the only true star this town has ever had. And Tuesday is usually the tepid day of death, though today it's just this empty boat of a silver dog, thumped with a buzzing fist of gold. Bees have attached a hive to its spine, and they drone in and out of it like a handbag stuffed with gossip and honey and another story that goes. In 1967, a wagon load of angry clowns passed through this town, and all the Catholic girls stepped out in night frost and no clothes. Though the Shriners still deny it, that procession lasted for nights. And I say, who's to say a clown, however bitter, however old, couldn't sire a human child among us like a god? Here it is, I tell you. Bend down here today and look at this strange harp, this jeweled and busy zither, dead and alive at the same time. Here God is. I'm going to read an older poem that I had planned to write for years and years. I carried around a clipping with me with the headline, and which is the title of the poem, Woman Kills Sweetheart with Bowling Ball. And this woman really did do that in Bloomington, Indiana. She dropped her lover's bowling ball on his head over and over again while he slept. I just really wanted to write a poem about it. It took me a long time to get to it. So kind of, and it very much scared my husband, who wondered why I carried this clipping around with me everywhere. But this is the poem, Woman Kills Sweetheart with Bowling Ball. The moon is loose in the gutter tonight, and it rolls without kisses or handprints between us. Its mouth is an O of surprise. Oh, tonight the phantasma of love climbs the stairs while we sleep. She sags with exhaustion and booze and pills while her skin hangs heavy and empty as hate. She floats so slow she floats as if she is swimming through blood. Shh, shh, the lights are out, and the little suspicion sleeps and dreams and whimpers in its crib. Its tongue is ugly and blue. She climbs in silence and fury, spinning groggy in darkness and wind. Look, her left hand bears for you sweetly a gift of lightning and lilies to please you, though, oh, tonight in her right hand she has invented gravity. This is Babysitter. When I was 16, I decided to eat the underworld fruit. What the hell, I said. It was juicy and cold. My hair was black, so I dyed it black, and I wore nothing but black. I still have the skull tattooed on my ass. I never cried, and I never laughed. I decided to reinvent silence right in my own home. My father's hair went white overnight, and he hung up his mailman blues and retired. My mother fell down the stairs and died. My father said he was glad at least she couldn't see what would become of me. That winter, I divided the bear arrows up among my friends. Aim to kill, I said, and I tacked its head to the post of my bed. At night, it sang its grisly song to me, and I slipped my neck between its teeth. I trust you completely, I said. For attention at school, I swallowed fire, I ate crow's whole, and once I jumped out from behind a bush and scared a priest to death. At 16, I discovered sex in the back seat of a cannibal's car, though we only went so far. It was my first taste of human flesh, and it was tender and sweet. When I was 16, the beast came looking for me. Some of my friends impaled themselves on rusty knives, while I was granted eternal life. I don't know why. Wild dogs followed me home. Rabid bats ate from my hand. And children loved me. At night, while you were out dancing, your children gathered around me and put their little raccoon hands in mine. I imagine a lot of you have seen the movie A Place in the Sun. And this poem is called Thunder or A Place in the Sun. And the part that refers to that movie, I'm sure you know the scene where Montgomery Clift is going to knock his wife, or, you know, his pregnant girlfriend, they're not married yet, his pregnant girlfriend into the water and she can't swim. And even though it seems really like a bad thing to do since she's pregnant and she's so homely and everything, you really, you know, want him to because she looks so ugly and he could marry Elizabeth Taylor and be happy. And so you just really want to see him just like whack her out of the boat. Or I do anyway. So that's what this poem is about. Thunder or A Place in the Sun. One. The gods are bowling in heaven tonight. Their wives cry into their own black hair while the kitchen's strange machinery minces and hatches. I arrange this. I arrange that. I move from room to room. Two. Lightning strikes me as similar to love. The ruins in some countries are tooth white and stunning in sun, pillars holding up nothing but blue air and light. He writes on the back of the postcard, I knew something somewhere was holding that up, didn't you? Three. My friend tells me that high heels were invented to keep housewives from running away, like the fists of bound feet in China, lovely as doves and blunt as clubs. True enough, I tell her, I've never run. But my heart is a boot with blood on it. Four. There's a long line outside the liquor store on Fridays in the summer, the lottery and beer. We're all in the same line, the same boat here. In A Place in the Sun, there is the old woman warble of loons and square-jawed Alice. Her face grows larger and larger in our boat. Behind us, the slim hope of the idle rich. Before us, fog crinolines out of the Campbell's soup, a muddle of plaid furniture and empty shoes. We'd also rather die than be stuck with our own lives, our own homely wives, both of them thick and dopey, and she can't swim. Back there, something gorgeous as Liz Taylor waits between layers and layers of light white cake if we win. Five. I stare at my own feet a long time outside the liquor store. True, I've never run in these red heels, but I've been run from. I've watched one husband cup his hands around a bullet hole as if to keep the river in him. Lungs hissing a bit, like the teapot wanting to boil. When he opened his mouth, a pink froth came out, a silver wind in my face. This is called Prayers to Saint Vanity. One. My dry well, I beseech thee, this old lighthouse, once it could catch fire and burn the woman inside alive. Two. In Alpena, they'll tell you a lightkeeper's wife haunts Lake Huron out of spite. She wails over the waves. Her ghost is a gull, a cloud, a rag, a trout with wings and gray. They say the lightkeeper locked her in the lighthouse every night, then went to visit a girl in town. Finally, she burned it down with herself inside, alive. Three. Saint Vanity, my body is that burning tower tonight with that mad wife inside, with that feverish girl outside waiting for him in town. Lake Huron is a blue-black churning urge to drown, colder and more filmy than a tooth. Some mornings I ride my stationary bike all the way to Vietnam. There my husband is 18, and either he's kissing a pretty whore or cradling a corpse. I see how close the bullets sing to his sweet feet. How unlikely is this life? Those bullets peel, and when I wake, he's still asleep beside me in Alpena at the Fountain of Youth RV park. Now I could sew my own shroud closed, or a dead Marine could unzip his own body bag, glistening with rain and green, the zither of plastic and a zipper's nasty teeth. And my husband could step out. Love, he'd say, is bloodless, wonderful, and dull as death by natural causes. 4. And you, Saint Vanity, you wear silver sandals and you perch on my shoulder every morning. You're a little Betty Grable with 40-year-old legs. Ships have sunk with trunks of money and all our mother's lovers just because the light in that lighthouse was out. My dry well, I tell you, when my husband touches me, my insides are a herd of skinny girls running backwards, laughing, making kisses at the sky. 5. Saint Vanity, you know so well the differences between the fears of the rich, the fears of the poor, the fears of the beautiful, the fears of the homely, the fears of the young, the fears of the old, the desire to die and the act of dying, and you cannot bless us all. And this last poem is called Ravine. At night we crawled out of our windows with our parents' bottles while they were drunk and locked in combat. Dogs would strain their chains at the stars and the smell of girls' underwear in backyards as we shuffled over the summer stumps of suburban grass. We wore our hair orange in those days, ugly and amazing as grace. We talked on and on about boys as if we knew one, and now I bleed with nostalgia to think of that, the wet banks of the ravine where we slid down to drink, just two girls getting immaterial on wine, maybe smoking if we had one, sucking the kitchen lights in the distance down like a smoldering forest of pines. The heart named us sisters with its dull thumping. I loved her with pain like handfuls of ice. She loved me enough to let me go on and on as no one ever has about my body parts, my optimistic theory about development and growth while we were in the bubbling test tube of it. Sometimes we would lift our arms up and sing while the moon trampled us with green light. Mindless, we were that young, and in the little light we got, once or twice we found in that damp slash evidence that other life existed, a milky rubber dried up and open-mouthed as a baby bird hauled out of a nest to its death by gravity and wind, thinking as it shriveled bald and wet through air that at least it knew what flight would be like if it had feathers to do it. We poked it up with a stick and whipped it into the air. It thrilled us as much as sex ever would, as if something had shed its better skin in our path. Thank you very much.
And now I have the pleasure of introducing a second remarkable writer to you, winner of this year's Poets and Writers Exchange in Fiction, David Reynolds. David Reynolds received his Bachelor of Arts from University of California at Santa Cruz and his Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Michigan. His stories have appeared in the Three Penny Review, Passages North, and a chapter from his novel In Progress appears in the 1994 Best of Writers at Work anthology. He currently writes and edits for the Physics Department at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. The manuscript David submitted to this competition is an excerpt from the novel he's currently working on, In the Waiting World. Set in Russia at the turn of the century, more specifically set in the Jewish village of Rafalovka, we see the once ordered and calm lives of people encroached upon first by rumors of pogroms in other parts of Russia, increasing rumors of persecution, and finally no rumor at all but the ominous arrival of a troop of Cossacks to Rafalovka and the traumatic chain of events occasioned by this hostile, ultimately terrible event. Told with grace, grave authority, and a lyrical grasp of language that is often breathtaking, David Reynolds, with delicate precision, reconstructs a tragic episode in Russian Jewish history. In so doing, he disrupts our own peace, disturbs, and forces us to look at the grotesquely barbarous behaviors of human beings toward one another. Lulled, even entranced, by the surety of his gift for observation and narrative control, we detach easily from our own age and specific moral dilemmas, and attach ourselves instead to the tragic plight of men, women, and children forced by hostile circumstance to extraordinary and even heroic response. The literary critic John Barber has said tragedy raises a basic religious question. How can the worth of human existence be affirmed in the light of our experience of evil and suffering and in light of our knowledge of man's inhumanity to man? Tragedy offers a reaffirmation of a particular kind of virtue. It provides trust or confidence in the worth of human existence in spite of its threats and terrors and failures. In being the bad conscience of their time, authors of tragedy perform the service Nietzsche demanded of the ideal philosopher. When one is as sincerely regretful to come to the end of this manuscript as I was, when one longs to read on, when one's emotional investment in character and event is so strong as to create a kind of nostalgia for what is yet missing, it seems clear that the author of this artistry, this story magic, David Reynolds, is well deserving of this award, as well as his readers' enthusiastic praise. David.
Thanks very much. That was very nice. I want to thank poets and writers, and certainly Fraser Russell. This has been a very nice week, and you've really put yourself out for us. And thanks, Laura, for a great reading. And all of you for coming. I'm going to read a pretty edited chapter. What you have to know, I guess, aside from what Melissa Pritchard told you, is that the father is absent because he's in America. The rest of the action is in Russia. The year is 1905. Okay. And this chapter is called Hush, Noah. Noah remembered Mama taking him to Moshi Kalat for shoes. The shop faced the street at its muddiest, where on Market Monday the peasants roamed their pigs, five doors down from the mildewy storefront where Ephraim taught Noah and seven other boys Torah. He remembered the capable hands while they held his foot. The knuckles were knobbed like burls swollen from little branches, the skin calloused and gnawed by tanning acid, and Noah trusted him to build a good shoe. There was something pleasant and intimate and unsettling in the way Kalak's fingers touched the bones in the top of Noah's foot, and his thumb pressed the sole, as if they could tell things about him from the give and the cartilage, from the thickness of the boy's first innocent calluses. The peculiar intimacy made Noah furrow his brow to look remote and keep from smiling. And even as a boy of eight, he thought Kalak's hand beautiful, like a body that, having done the same work for years, molds to the shape of its activity. Noah's added two more to the hundreds of feet he had measured and touched. Maybe Kalak was pleased by the variety of feet that had walked in and out of his door, that had been warmed by his hands, but maybe he never thought about it and worked with pleasureless concentration. While wrapping his tape measure around Noah's foot and toes and ticking the numbers in his head, somewhere at the sides of his tongue, he looked forward to his wife's chicken and beets without a thought for Noah's foot or for Noah. Some people are like that. They have a moment's curiosity about others, and Moshi always seemed to be one of these people, with nothing on his mind but measuring tape and leather. Mama chatted with him about the cold coming in behind the clouds and the water in the street that they all knew would freeze in a matter of weeks. Mostly, Kalak worked quietly, arching his back in such a way that his face stayed angled towards Noah's feet and showed that he didn't feel talkative. Sometimes it's hard to reconcile a person you know with things that you know have happened to him. You hear a painful story, and in your mind you superimpose an image of its events onto an image of that person you know, whomever it happened to. It's a way of coming to believe what you know is true but can't get your imagination to wrap around, to suckle and cradle, to make it feel real. Sometimes when a terrible thing happens to someone, your mind rearranges its picture of him until he's the type of person to whom bad things happen, someone marked since birth for tragedy, whose life has spent itself unfolding towards certain grim and inevitable moments. 1905's revolutionary agitation had spread from bigger cities along the railroads. It touched port cities such as Odessa. It touched towns with major railroad exchanges, though Rafalovka saw no outward sign of these distant events, no posters hastily pasted on walls by moonlight and torn down or replaced by morning, no pre-dawn arrest of political men or newspaper editors, as in Pinsk, No demonstrations or riots broke out. No fist fights, as in Lutsk, where somebody burned the post office after an argument, stopping all Rafalovka-bound mail. No one in Rafalovka noticed that the railroad briefly stopped running because no railroad came near the village. But the year began with stories of attacks on Jews in southern towns. Noah's mother tried to protect him from such stories, but it was impossible. In a distant town, the mother of a family friend was set on fire by neighbors, and in summer Label, the shopkeeper learned that his cousin, a rabbi in the south, had been hanged. The apprehensive mood in Rafalovka by late summer had thickened from the nervousness of the beginning of the year into a sort of languid anxiety. As the leaves began turning, a widespread insomnia sent townspeople into the streets at night, all tired and helpless and quiet, and it was common to see people reclining on the town square benches at all hours in the starlight, grimly contemplating their fingers, the mud and pebbles on the ground, the sparkle on the insides of their eyelids that kept them awake. It was as if the fear had stirred some viral sleeplessness from the marshes, and the collective insomnia settled so thick the town council voted to light the four gas lamps at the corners of the square. The lights gave a mangy flicker to all the shadows, as if the town had been submerged underwater and all the sleepless Jews wandered on a lake floor, and a traveler might think he had stumbled on a weird convergence of ghosts or angels who would without notice begin to lift from their benches until the sky would fill with the black shape of sleeplessness. A band of soldiers, Cossacks, a dozen or so who must have separated from their regiment, was seen on the outskirts of town, apparently stabling their horses with peasants near Avigdor's mill. For about a week, it was a regular occurrence for Jews to encounter them, but without incident. The Cossacks ignored the Jews, and the Jews passed them with polite and uneasy calm. 1 week had passed by the time four of them rode into town to Label's store for provisions. Theirs was a polite robbery. Like any customers, upon entering, the last of them closed the door gently behind him rather than let it slam. They collected kerosene, kasha, horse feed, and beans, and hard candy from Warsaw. When they collected what they wanted, the ranking officer curtly bowed to Label and led the others out to their horses. They didn't live up to their reputation for wildness, but their calm was frightening. They had brought a wintry quiet into town on the clopping of their horses' hooves, and their officer quietly upset the Jews with his way of looking at buildings but never people, as if even the most crowded Sabbath Eve street were empty. This calm ended after one of them rode into town on Sabbath and took Moshe Kalik's three hens. He rode in the middle of the street slowly, and later Nettie, who saw everything, said that he seemed to be prowling for a young girl and not just hens. The Cossack had been sitting for hours on his horse at the top of the road without moving, as if a copper statue had been erected at night, staring down into town with something blunt and metallic in the angle of his shoulders and a quality in his eyes like settled metal filings that wouldn't stir. He trampled the beans and green onions and pulled the door from the hen house while Moshe huddled inside with his wife and an arm around each of his two daughters, Gossie and Rina. Gossie is 10 and Rina is 13. In this moment, Noah's teacher, Ephraim, passed the home on his way to Shul. But instead of watching from a careful distance like the others in the road, he walked to the edge of Kalik's yard. Later in the evening, when everyone gathered around him at Shul, Ephraim didn't remember exactly what he had said, only that he was scared and he was mad at the Cossacks for scaring people, for scaring him, and for stealing so brazenly. The Rafalovkers at first treated the teacher as the bravest man in the world, and their awe must have made him feel strong. In another situation, the Rafalovkers would have exaggerated their stories about the incident wildly, exchanging reports that would grow more ludicrous with each telling, as if each storyteller competed with the last and had to tell the story better than the person he heard it from. Often in their town, tales inflated to such nonsense, people simply stopped telling them out of embarrassment. We might have heard that Ephraim had leapt into the mud yard and wrenched the hens from the Cossack and chastised him as he would his own pupil, and the Cossack had returned the hens in repentant shame and joined a monastery. But the moment was too unsettling for the Rafalovkers to allow that sort of exaggeration, and the story was told much as it happened. The teacher had said, "Those aren't your hens." It seemed stupid. What a ridiculous thing. He knew he couldn't order the Cossack to put the chickens down. The Cossack wound his cord around the neck of the jerking sack of chickens and tied it to his saddlebags. When they were secure, he swung his body up and rode into the street, where he stopped in front of the teacher. His horse lifted its hooves one at a time from the mud, impatient, but the Cossack was unhurried. Now the teacher must have been scared crazy, but he began shouting at the Cossack. a flood of barely intelligible curses in Russian, calling him a robber, a thug, cursing his genitals and descendants. By the time he seemed to realize what he was doing, it was too late to stop, so he just kept on until he exhausted himself and then caught his breath. And those watching were amazed the Cossack hadn't chopped him in two. A few had stopped on the far side of the road, but none did anything to help. What could be done? The Cossack stared dully at Ephraim. He hadn't changed his expression from the concentration with which he stuffed chickens into the sacks. The teacher, his sense returned, said in Russian, "What? Are you going to kill me?" The Cossack smiled. He seemed to think about this. He seemed to think about it with the muscles around his mouth and the way he wet his mustache with his lip, as if the taste of the hair told him what he thought. When he seemed to have tasted enough to make a decision, he reached his hand down and touched the teacher's face. His fingers stroked Ephraim's cheek and jaw. The tenderness of this touch chilled the people in the street, and when the Cossack pulled his hand back and rode away, they crowded around the flustered teacher to see if he was all right. Moshe Kalik came from his house with a bottle of Slivovitz and sat Ephraim on the windowsill to make him drink. "You'll spill it the way your hands are shaking," said Kalik, and he held the bottle for the teacher as if he fed milk to a baby. That night, Mama told Noah that he would go to his teacher in the morning as usual. "He's a good man," she said. "Soldiers will come after him," said Noah. Mama was busy knitting. Noah stared at her to make her look at him. "You will be the only boy in Cheder tomorrow," she said. "Are you scared, Noah?" "I'm not scared," he said. "Some of our friends are treating your teacher badly," she said. He hated her frank tone. She was too grave and serious with him, and he shifted around in his seat to keep from running away. "He behaved very bravely," she said, "but some people think he shouldn't have." She put down her knitting, and he climbed into her lap. "They're afraid, and they don't want their children to go near him because they think he's in danger. But we don't want to abandon him, do we, Noah? We don't want him to feel alone." She probed his face to see if he understood. "I'm not afraid of anything in the world," she said, "as long as you are safe." He thought she was going to cry. "I'm safe," he said. "I want you to understand why you're going to Ephraim tomorrow," she said. Her voice was shaky, and Noah began to cry. "You can cry for a minute, Noah," she said. She let him cry, and then she said, "Now you have to stop." He hugged her harder and wouldn't let go when she pushed him gently from her lap. "My knitting's all crushed," she said. "Now go wash." "No," he said, rubbing his eyes. "Go wash," she said again. He slapped her on the arm and then stared at her, waiting for her to rage. But instead of losing her temper, she took up her knitting. She looked away from him with such disappointment, as if he was nothing, that he fled to his bed and hid in the covers. As Mama had said, there were no other boys in Cheder. Ephraim looked as though he'd been up all night. He lurched to the door to greet Noah, smelly, his shirts flapping, and as if nothing were unusual, asked after his parents. Noah said his mother was mending sheets and winter blankets. The teacher said it was a good thing to mend winter blankets because the air would be cold soon and it would be time to put in the winter windows. Noah kept his hands at his sides on the chair. The teacher said that late every winter, the cotton he put between the window panes to soak the moisture mildewed, and that was how he knew that winter was ending and the time to remove the extra glass had come. And wasn't that a good time of year when the season changes into spring and we can again look forward to warm weather? Noah said, "Yes, sir, that's a good time of year." "Should I send you home, Noah?" the teacher blurted. He looked embarrassed, hearing himself, and Noah was embarrassed for him. "Did your papa ever take you to see them ride?" the teacher said. "Their horsemanship shows, their magic." "No," said Noah. "You would think they could fly. They spook their horses to incredible feats. My father took me when I was your age. I was a bit older than you. It was the Don Cossacks, and they had set up outside of Odessa." "My father never took me," said Noah. "No, they can jump a horse through a flaming hoop," said Ephraim. "It's wonderful. We cheered until our throats were too scratched to talk. They can ride at you in full gallop and spear a pear in your mouth and leap over you without disturbing your hat." Noah's mother insisted that he had seen his teacher be shot. Even when he denied it, when he shook his little head vigorously, his mother didn't seem to hear. or else she decided his denial was too emphatic to be believed. Ephraim had ordered Noah to open his book, and then they had heard glass breaking down the street. It was followed by the crash of a window falling in on itself, and the teacher, without any sign of surprise, stiffened his neck and touched his window for a moment as he looked into the street. He crossed from the window to the back of the room, to a trunk behind the long tables, where the boys ate lunch. His face was stern when he looked at Noah, but also reassuring, and Noah didn't want to look away. He just wanted to look at that face and be sure everything would be all right. The teacher pulled an armload of blankets from the trunk and heaped them onto the floor. As he emptied the trunk and made Noah get inside, he had a peculiar expression, as if he was separating from his body, that it was acting on its own without thought of bravery or fear, and that he had stepped back behind some translucent screen of disbelief through which he would watch the moments unfold. In the street, people shouted and more glass broke. Noah thought he recognized the voices, and he worried about his mother. She would be home doing chores at that time, or she might be in the garden, where she could be seen by anybody passing. Ephraim ordered Noah into the trunk. Noah wanted to go home and find his mother, but he climbed into the trunk because Ephraim's instructions were so firm. "You mustn't let anyone know you're in there," said the teacher. The trunk smelled of wood and wool from the blankets that the teacher had just removed. He shut the lid, and Noah curled with his side hard against the base of the box. With his hands pressed beneath his mouth, he listened, but heard nothing of what happened outside of his trunk, no hiss of fire and no breaking glass. There were only smells and darkness. The old smell of the spruce, which still held itself faintly beneath the stronger smells of the blankets, and a living smell, even softer than these, as if it had been carried in the blankets and scooped away with them, but still left a residue. It was the smell of an adult's body at night, the sleeping smell secreted from skin and breath into wool. Noah inhaled through his nose to get the smell deep into him, into his throat and onto his tongue, as if it would accompany him and shield him from whatever was about to happen. Even his mother came into that box because he had been lying there so long his body ached. She was just behind his head, forgiving him for having hit her. She was looking down at the back of his neck and reaching her hand for him, preparing to stroke the hair at the base of his skull. She held her hand inches from his head without touching. He tightened his arm around his knees and waited. Noah remained in the trunk until the rabbi opened it and lifted him out by the arms. All that happened while he was hidden inside was told over and over for years, but Noah did not remember any of it. Ephraim was shot through the window, but didn't die. He was shot in the mouth and also injured by broken glass, which resulted in complications and lingering infections, which confined him to a sanitarium in Pinsk, where he spent the rest of his life. The Cossacks had either noticed Kalik's daughters or had heard about them from their hen-stealing companion. On a whim, one of the Cossacks threw lamp oil on Moshe Kalik's roof and set it on fire. The girls ran out of the house with her father to escape from burning. Two Cossacks threw the girls over their saddles and sat on them to stop them from swinging their fists. Kalik wailed and threw himself at the horses. The Cossacks swung their bayonets at him, striking him lightly with the flats, pleased to make him watch as they prepared to ride off with his children. He tried to put out the eye of one of the horses, but stepped on a piece of fallen, burning roof, and had to dance on one foot to put out the flame that started on his pant leg. The Cossacks couldn't decide what to name this dance, sort of a lame-footed kazatska, they said, but they appreciated his talent and they clapped for him, saying that for an older man he was very nimble, and that he must have been a charmer for the ladies when they danced their Jew dances. He did not attack them again. And it seemed to those who saw that fear overwhelmed his fatherly love, though he managed to run after them for a short distance while they rode out of town. Noah was only 8, but he knew what the Cossacks did to Rina, because adults can lose their sense of discretion when shaken and sometimes say too much, even around children. He knew that the girls were never found, but that several days after the raid, after a week or 10 days, someone found, and he didn't know who, some man out walking, maybe a peasant, maybe Yosef, the rabbi's simple helper who took long walks for his heart, or someone who had bought something from a peasant and was returning with buttons or leather or nails, and it was never determined to whom they belonged, but they were a young person's, a young woman's. Somebody found hands. They held a funeral for the girls and buried the hands in a child's coffin, designating the grave as a grave for both girls. I won't go into the fighting over whether it was appropriate or even permitted to assume both girls dead, but in the end, this is what was done, partly to keep Moshi Kalit from wandering helplessly through the countryside looking for them, though it didn't quell the hope that they were alive somewhere, perhaps taken by the Cossacks to a convent where they would be raised as Christians. And Noah was tormented by the thought that one day, as an old man in some dim Arctic railroad station, with frost on the metal benches and snow garnishing the window panes, he would encounter an elderly nun who had no hands. After the raid, Noah's mother treated him as though the attack had transformed him. He was now needy and traumatized. He wanted to return to his normal self, but she wouldn't let him. And things as minor as a stubbed toe inspired her pity, a nightmare, and she bought him sugared crackers and sat with him in the dark, rubbing the damp hair over his temples long after he wanted her to leave him. Every solicitous, painfully exaggerated expression of concern from his mother reminded him that something bad had not only happened to him, but had changed him. It made him think that he had been weakened, like the occasional sickly and moribund child who appears in Cheder for a few months, never speaks, and just as mysteriously disappears. He had fingers and looked at her as though she were a stranger. On the third Monday after the girls disappeared, Mama brought Noah with her to the markets, along with his friend Yudel. She was preparing to pay a condolence call on Moshi Kalit when Kalit burst from his store and ran at a peasant's pig who stood in the water in the road. Kalit ran out to chase it off as Mama approached his store. Noah could see as Kalit ran from the doorway that something was not right. His face was screwed up in frenzy as he bore down on the pig. Without even lifting his hands to block the impact, Moshi ran right against its side. His big belly thumped the pig's ribs, and then he dropped hard onto his back. The pig looked down at him. Not even its knees had shuddered on impact. Mama touched her finger to her lip in alarm. Kalit rolled on his back in the puddle. Mama told the boys to go into the butcher shop and not look. Kalit began to shout obscene curses about peasants, and he wouldn't stand. At this moment, Noah decided he hated him. His vehemence was like a bile he couldn't swallow, and as it came up, he wanted to kick that balding head open. The pig watched Kalit as if it also wanted to kick him. Noah's mother lifted Kalit by the arm, smoothed his shirt and hair, and led him into his store where she lowered the blinds. After the blinds had been drawn, Noah patted the pig, because they both hated Kalit now, and then the boys began laughing. Noah couldn't remember having laughed so hard. When he tried to stop, he could only laugh harder. It was a sort of laughing that hurt his stomach, brought tears to his eyes, and made him worry about vomiting. Both of the boys laughed, and they argued about who would laugh first. After they disagreed for a few minutes, Noah punched Yudel in the eye. Yudel hit him back, and they wrestled each other to the ground. Finally, Noah's mother ran from Moshi Kalik's shop and separated them, yanking them to their feet and slapping her hand hard across both of their faces. Although Kalik loved his daughters more than himself and would in a lucid moment give his life for either of theirs, the suddenness of fire in his roof, the windows smashing on each side at once, the Cossacks surrounding the house and rearing up on their horses, and the horses' fear of the flames all seemed to force everything out of him. One moment he heard disturbance in the street, the next he was rushing his girls into the arms of these soldiers who took them so fast he must have been paralyzed. For a moment he just stopped. Things were happening all around him. He couldn't have fully believed the moment in which he found himself. And then his girls were flung across the saddles with soldiers sitting on them. And years later, in a frank and drunken moment, Kalik remembered to several men how the saddles were slung with sharp things, metal clasps, poorly sheathed blades, and that he had worried that the girls would be cut or struck by something, as if for a moment he had lost the fact that they were being taken away. "Isn't that stupid?" he had said. He didn't become aware of himself again until he had been running in the road for some time, already outside of town and following its curve into the marshy woods. He had hurt his foot in the fire. The Cossacks were long out of sight. Neighbors had put out his burning roof. Thank you.